years ago, and I never realized until today that the Adventist presence in Canyonville is as significant as it is. I see you have a nice church, a school nearby, and other Adventist facilities here. It's a privilege to be with you. I'll try to make sure my equipment is working. I am thankful for this device that was given to me. It's much better than trying to speak through my cloth, a mask that my wife made for me. When things closed down, back whenever it was now, it seems like ancient history. We've been wearing masks for a long time. But we were studying the book of Daniel in our Sabbath school classes. And when we could no longer go to church, to Sabbath school, I kept studying that well-written quarterly, and I became very interested in the book of Daniel, and especially Daniel's last vision, the last three chapters of Daniel, chapters 10, 11, and 12. And I don't usually present something like this the first time I'm visiting a church, but I got so wrapped up in it that I just wanted to present what I was in the process of studying and learning about. One of the most interesting parts of the Bible is Daniel's last vision. He must have been about 88 years old at the time that he had this vision, but obviously his mind was still very sharp. This vision was longer and more detailed than all of the other previous visions that he had had and that are recorded. And unlike the ones before it, there are no dreadful beasts so common in apocalyptic prophecy. Daniel's last prophecy is written in plain language. This morning, I'd like to study parts of Daniel chapters 10, 11, and 12 with you. A thorough verse-by-verse study of these three chapters would probably take between 2, 3, or 4 hours. But what I plan to do is to give you a quick overview of all of the material and then focus on the last five verses of Daniel chapter 11. This is the part that deals with our day and what could be happening in the not-too-distant future. I'll test make sure I have it turned on here. It's turned on. It's turned on. Okay. I pushed that one there. That's when
does the slide have focus? Up there. Yeah, restart the program.
I could give him a signal. If it doesn't work, I can give him a signal and turn it forward for me.
You're good. This is the one you want right here.
Okay. Sorry, I'm new to this system. Daniel had his vision in about 536 BC when Cyrus the Great was in his third year as king of Persia. And verse 4 gives us some more very important information, chronological data. It says, "And in the 24th year of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river," and this is the only full date that Daniel gives us in his entire book. It tells us that the vision took place on the 24th of Nisan in the year 536 BC. That would be the months of March or April on our calendar. In other words, it was springtime. And the great river Hiddekel at that time must have been in flood. When I saw this precise date, the first question I asked myself was, what day of the week was this particular date, the 24th? In his book on Daniel, Dr. William Shea tells us that Daniel received his final prophecy on the Sabbath. Apparently, he was out walking by the riverside on a Sabbath with some of his friends, and he was taken off in vision at this time. And the Bible tells us his friends fled in fear. Suddenly, a majestic being appeared to Daniel, standing above the water. It was none other than Jesus Christ. And the angel Gabriel was nearby. You can read all about this in this amazing experience of Daniel in the 10th chapter of Daniel. His description of Jesus was very similar to John's description in the first chapter of Revelation. After Daniel's encounter with Jesus, Gabriel took him, that's Daniel, down through 2,500 years of prophecy, history in advance. It's really a very fascinating prophecy. Since we don't have time to look at all the details of this 2,500-year prophecy, let me summarize the material just briefly for you. On the screen, it shows at a glance what Daniel's last vision was all about. In Daniel 11:2, he begins with a brief comment on Persia. In verses 3 through 15, he deals with Greece, including Alexander the Great and the split into four kingdoms following Alexander's death. Then the chapter continues with the struggles between the king of the north and the king of the south. Unfortunately, poor little Israel was caught right between these two warlike kings, and they suffered significantly. Verses 16 through 29 refer to imperial Rome, including a brief mention of Christ's birth and also of his crucifixion. Verses 30 through 45 deal with papal Rome. And this seems to be the main emphasis of the chapter, of the vision. Also, this vision parallels all of Daniel's other visions. In other words, it goes through the same sequence of countries, underscoring the importance of parallelism as a basic biblical hermeneutic. Since the struggle between the king of the north and the king of the south is one of the main parts of this vision, let me just review some of the aspects of the prophecy very quickly. On the screen, you can see that Israel was located right between the Seleucids, the kings of the north, and the Ptolemies, the kings of the south. And if you go through those early verses in chapter 11, you're dealing with a lot of detail. And it would take quite a while to go through all of that. Sadly, little Israel was right between, and they suffered significantly. History will repeat itself at the time of the end, and spiritual Israel will also suffer. Now we've come to the main part of our study. Verse 40 is the high point of Daniel's vision. The prophecy thus far has covered about 2,300 years of history, and now we're dealing with the time of the end. Let me ask you, this is a good Adventist group here, when does the time of the end begin? Okay, 1798, and that's a very important date in this particular prophecy. But why does Daniel emphasize 1798 in this prophecy? Well, let's go on. Let's look at Daniel 11, verse 40 again. It says, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him." What does this word push mean? Well, in Hebrew, the word push means to butt with horns, to gore, or to make war. So, what is this verse telling us? It's telling us that in 1798, the king of the south was going to make war against the king of the north. And in this chapter, going back to about verse 30, the king of the north has been the papacy. But who is the king of the south? Sorry, I'm trying to get used to this. You feel like you're in a different room from me. But who is the king of the south? To answer that, we need to know who was making war on the papacy in 1798. Well, back in 1798, a French general by the name of Louis-Alexandre Berthier took Pope Pius VI prisoner and hauled him off to the city of Valence in southern France. It was France, as I'm sure you all know, that inflicted the deadly wound on the King of the North at that time. Then, France is symbolized in Revelation as Egypt. When Moses asked Pharaoh to free God's people, Pharaoh responded by saying, "Who is Jehovah? That I know not Jehovah, and moreover, I will not let Israel go." During the French Revolution, France, like Egypt, officially denied the very existence of God. From this we can see that the king of the south is atheism. And in our day, many countries have officially espoused atheism. This map that you can see on the screen shows how very successful the King of the South has been. You can see that a large part of the world has officially opted for atheistic communism. And I might say not all of the countries are shown on the map. Some of them in Latin America were not included. But atheism, of course, as you know, is not restricted only to communist countries. There are significant elements of atheism even in the so-called Christian countries, but their governments have not officially opted for atheism. This verse, verse 40, is loaded with major information. Let's read the whole verse through so we can get the force of what's going on. It says, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, and chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." This text is predicting a total papal comeback. The deadly wound will heal completely. And the next text says that it will happen like a whirlwind. This suggests either force or speed, maybe both, and the final movements will be rapid ones. Chariots and horsemen symbolize military might, or at least the strong arm of the state. And many ships symbolize trade and economic power. Basically, this verse is telling us that the king of the north is going to regain the power it lost back in 1798. We all know that papal power comes through the union of church and state. So how strong is the king of the north today? Let's take a quick look. The papacy is the world's oldest institution, continuously in existence since about the 6th century. It's the world's largest institution, numbering about 1.1 billion members. That's about one out of every seven people in the world today. And it's found in 215 countries. And I might throw in parenthetically here, it took them 1,500 years to reach this number of countries. It so happens that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is in 215 countries today. And if you take the beginning as 1863 when the church was formed, what would that be? About 147 years, something. In other words, it didn't take us 1,500 years. The King of the North is also possibly the world's wealthiest institution. They have millions of acres of land, tons of gold, silver, precious stones, thousands of buildings, including grand basilicas, art collections, rare documents, and millions of shares in business corporations worldwide. And today, it's one of the two superpowers of Revelation chapter 13. He who controls the minds of the people, including powerful world leaders, is obviously in a powerful condition. The Holy See also has the world's largest espionage network. And this network has 1,500 years of experience. It includes popes, cardinals, archbishops, bishops, priests, nuns, sisters, and zealous laymen. And frequently, they place Vatican interests before that of their own countries. The backbone of this worldwide network consists of thousands of well-trained operatives in the Society of Jesus. And as you know, this society came about into existence to counter Protestantism. And also, of course, the Reformation. World leaders converge on the Vatican today regularly, hoping to benefit from this wealth of information. And don't forget, this network is motivated by a belief that they are the sole purveyor of salvation in the world. Most Protestants don't seem to remember that the King of the North is aiming for global domination. Economically, it's very socialistic, and politically, I think we all know it is totalitarian. At this point, I think it would be helpful to compare both of the kings briefly, the King of the North and the King of the South. The King of the North and the King of the South are very similar in many ways. The enemy of souls is backing both kings. And remember, I'm talking about kings, not about the millions of members who are very fine and very sincere people. I'm talking about the leadership, and in this sense, the kings. They both would like to dominate the whole world, both King of the North and King of the South. Both are totalitarian. Both have left a trail of blood miles long. They are both persecutors. Both oppose God. One is Antichrist. The other is anti-God. And both have shown a keen dislike for both Protestantism and capitalism. And both have a long record of disregard for human rights and human freedoms. Scripture tells us that they are both empowered from below. You can read about it in Revelation chapters 11 and 17, as I'm sure you all have done. Verse 40 ends with a rather amazing prophecy. It says, "And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." This text tells us that the papacy will enter countries belonging to the King of the South, atheistic, communist countries. That word overflow in Hebrew, incidentally, is shataf, and it means conquer. So it's speaking very frankly. And remember, the papacy is used to conquering with the help of the state, of powerful friends. In Revelation 13, prophecy predicts the rise of another superpower. This one, as you all know, began to rise as a nation in 1776, just before the beginning of the time of the end. Today, it is the world's third largest country in both area and population. Arguably, it is number one in the area of usable land. Our competitors live in frozen areas, and so we have a great deal of usable land. Many Americans don't realize that the Department of Transportation in Washington, D.C. administers 9 time zones. And these time zones transcend the international dateline. On any given day, U.S. soil is some of the first to welcome the rays of the sun and some of the last on which the sun sets. Generally speaking, we're well supplied with an excellent array of soils and minerals, forests, water resources, and climates. The strength of our economy and of our military is well known. I don't need to talk about that. And in The Great Controversy, page 441, it tells us that Protestantism and Republicanism have been the secret of our power and our prosperity. On June 7, 1982, President Ronald Reagan met with Pope John Paul II for the first time to discuss how the communist countries of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union could be brought down. Reagan and the Pope formed an alliance to end communism in Poland and Eastern Europe. In 1984, for the first time in our history, the U.S. formally recognized the Holy See as a sovereign nation. In 1989, Poland conducted semi-free elections, and in 1990, Catholic Poland became a free democracy. Atheism was defeated. Pope John Paul used that victory in Poland to serve notice to the whole world. Note what the Jesuit author Malachi Martin says in his book, The Keys of This Blood. The point of John Paul's foray into Poland was that he was a geopolitical pope. He would enter the arena of politics worldwide. He intended to become active in major world affairs. For 1,500 years, Rome had kept a strong hand, even on the local level, in much of the world. But major secular powers had terminated that role about 200 years ago, as you all know, when the papacy received the deadly wound. But Pope Paul II was intending to tell us that he was going to heal, as it were, the deadly wound. On June 12, 1987, Ronald Reagan gave his famous speech in Berlin, in which he challenged the premier of the late Soviet Union, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. 2 years later, in 1989, the wall began coming down. By 1990, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, and Romania all ended their atheistic communist governments. But the big change was still to come. At the time, the Soviet Union was experiencing many economic and political problems internally. Amid these problems, Reagan saw another way to try to win the Cold War. He came up with the U.S. Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, as you all remember it, sometimes called Star Wars. The U.S. Star Wars were designed to push the USSR into an arms race that seriously exacerbated their economic problems. It worked. On December 26, 1991, the Soviet Union began coming apart. A major bastion of atheistic communism had come to its end. Now we come to that part of Daniel 11 that is of special interest to Seventh-day Adventists, that every Adventist should know about. Since verse 40, the King of the North has been moving quickly in its endeavor to control the world. The first part of verse 41 says, "He shall enter also into the glorious land." What does this mean? What is the glorious land? Well, back in Bible times, the glorious land was literal Israel. Today, the glorious land is spiritual Israel. And based on Galatians 3:29 and Revelation 14:12 and other texts, we can say that spiritual Israel refers to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Entering the glorious land indicates that a national Sunday law or that Sunday legislation has already been put in place, and the little time of trouble has begun. Great things are happening within the Seventh-day Adventist Church at this time. Let's take a closer look at what the little time of trouble is all about. The little time of trouble takes place between the passage of a national Sunday law and the close of probation. It's during this period that the shaking of Adventism occurs. And at the same time, or in that period, God's people receive the latter rain and proclaim the loud cry around the world. Buying and selling will be restricted. God's people will suffer persecution, and some will even lose their lives. What Daniel is saying here is big news for the Adventist Church. He is telling us that the lamb-like beast of Revelation 13 has just started to speak like a dragon. And he's inferring that the deadly wound of the papacy is healed completely. The fact that the land beast of Revelation 13 has approved Sunday legislation means that this nation has already formed an image of the beast. And knowing that the mark of the beast is the enforcement of Sunday worship, it's evident that the big time of trouble is just around the corner at that time. At that time, major changes will take place in the Adventist Church. In the previous verse, I'm referring to verse 41 there, the term glorious land refers to the worldwide Seventh-day Adventist Church. And the term glorious holy mountain is verse 45, in verse 45, and it's referring also to the worldwide Seventh-day Adventist Church. But notice that the glorious land in verse 41 is not described as holy. Only the glorious holy mountain in verse 45 is said to be holy. So at some point between verses 41 and 45, a shaking process takes place within Adventism. There's a parting of the way in the remnant church. Those holding fast have a glorious holy mountaintop experience. This is significant because in this prophecy, Daniel 11, the shaking is the next event that takes place in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Let me throw in parenthetically here. Some of these things, as I have studied them recently, they may need to be studied by many minds. So if there's anyone that here that feels I'm in error, I would appeal to you to communicate with me. I do not want to say anything that is incorrect. But studying this chapter has been a very fulfilling study as I have gotten into some of these details. But verse 41 also contains some good news. It says, "And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon." Who are these peoples that Daniel is talking about here, these three nations? Well, in ancient times, these three nations were the descendants of Abraham and his extended family, and they lived on the eastern side of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea area. What's important in this context is that they symbolize those who come out of spiritual Babylon and flee to God's holy, glorious mountain just before probation closes. Many souls will be converted and enter the Seventh-day Adventist Church at the 11th hour, replacing those who had been shaken out. Verse 42 continues a very interesting prophecy. It says, "He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape." In verses 40 and 41, the king of the north has already been victorious in much of the world. Now he concentrates on what is still remaining. Since Egypt symbolizes atheism, this text is predicting that the remaining atheistic countries will also fall in line. As we look around us in the world today, we can see that there are only five atheistic communist countries left. They are the People's Republic of China, Laos, North Korea, Vietnam, and neighboring Cuba. When and how these countries succumb to the power of the King of the North is yet to be seen. We don't know. Perhaps spiritualism helps to speed the demise. Time will tell. But in Revelation 13, it says that all the world wondered after the beast. And if you read that chapter, read it carefully, it says that all of the world would wonder after the beast three times. It's not just once. So it must be an important factor there. In his book, Before Probation Closes, Lewis F. Weir describes the demise of communism very graphically. Communism and all the forces of anti-clericalism were permitted by the Lord to rise up against the authority and power of Rome. Today, this communistic element prevents the papacy rising to complete power. But the prophecy points to the time when, in the providence of God, The power of communism will be temporarily subdued, thus enabling the King of the North to obtain its lost supremacy. Then the remnant people of God, alone in a hostile world, will be the object of the hatred of the man of sin and the false prophet. The King of the North will also have tremendous influence over the finances of the world. Verse 43 says, "But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps." With such strong worldwide influence, it's easy to understand why one cannot buy or sell without permission at this time. Large amounts of wealth flow into the coffers of the King of the North as he seeks to conquer every corner of the globe. And these countries, Ethiopia and Libya, were sources of wealth for Egypt back then. Today, perhaps they symbolize the allegiance proffered by the remaining non-Christian world, the countries where Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam prevail. While the King of the North is subduing Libya and Ethiopia, the text there tells us he hears tidings out of the east and north that trouble him. In Libya, he hears the tidings coming from the east. In Ethiopia, he hears them coming from the north. So where are these tidings coming from? Well, Israel is east of Libya, and Israel is due north of Ethiopia. The tidings are coming from Israel, and in this case, it's spiritual Israel. Since Sunday laws should have already closed spiritual Israel down, the papacy is greatly troubled. So what are these tidings? Let me just say quickly, I see my time is well over. It's referring to the giving of the latter rain by God's people at that time. And the Lord's messenger tells us in great controversy, she describes this. You have all read it, I am sure. It's there on page 612. But we'll go on. The King of the North is enraged by this challenge to his authority. The second part of verse 44 says, "Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many." So with great fury, the papacy goes forth to destroy Israel, God's glorious holy mountain. The death decree is proclaimed. God's people have been experiencing the little time of trouble. Now probation closes and the great time of trouble, Jacob's time of trouble, begins. You're familiar with that text there in Revelation 12. It speaks of the dragon being wroth with the woman. We could go on in detail, but let me just push ahead here. We will at the very end of our study, we get into the two great times of trouble. That's in Daniel chapter 12, verse 1. And there it is telling us that there are two great times of trouble. One of them, of course, is long in duration from 538 to 1798. The time of Jacob's trouble is much shorter, but the intensity I cannot describe to you. One would have to experience that to know. But Daniel 12:1 brings us to the great climax of the ages. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, everyone that is found written in the book. This is the great day that the church, followers of Christ, have looked forward to down through the ages. Some of us here today might go through this experience, this time of trouble, and live to see Christ coming in the clouds of heaven. Others of us may rest and come forth in the resurrection at that time. But what a glorious day that will be. No more suffering, no more pain, no more war, and no more sin. We can look forward to that time, and as we look around us in the world today, we can see the signs that that could be sooner than we realize. Let's all prepare and be ready for that day, is my prayer.